the final 2.2 kilometers of these marathons, because the splits just allow you to do that. So you get splits up to 40K and then you've got that final 2.2K. And what we found there is that the people who speed up a lot in that final 2.2K, they tend to have poorer finish times than the people who don't speed up a lot. So why is that? I think one reason is that the fact that you can speed up a lot probably means that you've run a bit too conservatively up until that point in the race. And this just speaks to the difficulty of getting marathon pacing right, of course.
Welcome to No Finish Line, a podcast with John O'Regan, sponsored by Great Outdoors Dublin.
Hello and welcome back to another episode of No Finish Line Podcast, or if it's your first visit, then welcome to the podcast. In this episode, I'm delighted to be joined by Professor Barry Smith. Professor Barry Smith holds the Digital Chair of Computer Science in University College Dublin and is Director of the Insight Centre for Data Analytics. He's a Fellow of the European Coordinating Committee on Artificial Intelligence since 2003 and a member of the Royal Irish Academy since 2011. In 2014, Barry was awarded an honorary Doctor of Technology from Robert Gordon University in the UK, and he was the Director of the Clarity Centre for Sensory Web Technologies from 2008 to 2013. He has previously held the position of Head of School for the School of Computer Science and Informatics in UCD. Barry's research interests fall within the field of artificial intelligence and include case-based reasoning, machine learning, recommender systems, user modelling and personalisation. Since 1992, he has published over 400 peer-reviewed papers. Barry's research has attracted more than 13,000 citations. He has a H index of 58 and he's received more than 20 best paper awards for his work. In 2014, he was named the SFI Researcher of the Year, and his research interests extend beyond the laboratory, and over the years he has established a track record for successfully translating his research into commercial opportunities and received numerous awards for his commercialisation endeavour. As an example, in 2006 he was a finalist in the Ernst & Young Entrepreneur of the Year, and in 2012 he received the Irish Software Association Inaugural Award for Outstanding Achievement. In 1999, Barry co-founded Changing Worlds based on his personalization research and helped grow the company to more than 150 employees before it was acquired by Amdocs Incorporated in 2008. Also in 2008, he co-founded Haystacks based on his social search research, and he has helped Haystacks to raise more than 3.5 million in venture capital funding to date and continues to advise the company on its technology and market strategy. Barry is actively involved in the Irish startup scene, and as an advisor and investor, he serves on the boards of numerous local startups. He is also a member of the Irish Times Trust. So having listened to that intro, you're probably wondering what has all this to do with what I usually talk about. But what I didn't mention is that in the spare time, Barry likes to run marathons. Barry has run 8 marathons, and as we record, he's preparing and tapering for his 9th, which will be the Dublin Marathon on October the 29th. Barry, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks very much, John. And that must be the longest intro you've ever had to read. I must find where you found that.
It is, and I like to do my research. I know who I'm talking to. As I mentioned, I've been following you for a while, and I was trying to work out what we could actually talk about or how I could actually ask the right questions. But might start off by asking you, how's your training going, and will you be following a pacer on race day?
Yeah, it's going well. So what are we today? 10 days to go to Dublin. I'm living in constant fear that I'm going to pick up a cold or something between now and then. But training has gone really well this year, yeah. It's been one of my biggest years of training, and I'm sort of happy with that. We did our last marathon interval session last night in the pourings of rain. I think I reached peak human wetness last night. I think even my bones were wet by the time I got home, but it was great fun. Will I be following a pacer? I think so. I think I'll probably start out with the 3:20s and see how it goes, depending on conditions on the day.
And before we go any further into talking about the racing and that, Can you simplify what it is that you do and how does it cross over to marathon running?
Yeah, so it's a long story, but I'll give you the short version. I love working with data. And up until a few years ago, most of my professional research was using machine learning and AI technologies to deal with e-commerce style data, let's just say. So building recommendation systems of the sort that Amazon uses, you know, people who like this book also like that book, and building various machine learning systems. And I took up running about 10 or 12 years ago, and I realized, you know, there's a whole lot of running data out there. Wouldn't it be interesting as a little side project for the evenings to start analyzing marathon data, given that I was going to start running marathons, and see how do other people do it? So it started from there, looking at marathon race data, which is published on marathon websites around the world, building a large data set of that. Over the years, I was then fortunate to be able to work with Strava on some of the data that they have. And really then it became a matter of identifying interesting research questions, most of which had occurred to me during my own training and racing, and trying to answer those questions with the data. And it's ballooned since there, and now quite a significant portion of my research is focused on sports and exercise, and in particular marathon running, and in particular recreational runners. So I realized quite early on that most of the sports science research out there was focused on laboratory studies, small numbers of highly trained or elite athletes. And I realized that there was an opportunity to explore how regular runners like me were doing, because there was a lot more data about those runners. That's where I started, and that's where I am now. And it's great.
Now, before I go any further, I just want to mention that I've read a lot of your articles, just for anybody listening in, and they are all available on medium.com. your blog posts and some scientific papers. And one of those scientific papers is entitled Longer Discipline Tapers Improve Marathon Performance for Recreational Runners. How much importance do you place on the taper? And are you taking your taper seriously for this marathon?
Yeah, it's a good question. I put a lot of stock in the taper. Mostly because I'm exhausted by the time I get to it. I'm absolutely delighted that the volume is reducing a bit. But more seriously, I think I've always felt that it's been an important ingredient in my own marathon experiences. You know, arriving on race day and feeling pretty good and pretty rested has allowed me to do a lot more in the race, I feel, than I would have expected. So I think the taper is a big part of that. So I'm tapering at the moment. I tend to do a 3-week taper, gradually reducing the volume of training while keeping the intensity there. And that usually takes me to race day reasonably healthy and reasonably fit.
How do you analyse the taper? Where do you get the data for that?
So for that particular piece of research, we were using data that we had access to from Strava. So we had, for that research, I think it was about 150,000 runners. We had their training data for various marathons. And therefore, we were able to look at how those runners tapered. And in particular, you know, we were interested in, how long do they spend tapering? You know, some runners seem to spend only about a week tapering, maybe 2 weeks, maybe 3 weeks. We found some runners taking even 4 weeks and they started reducing their volume. So really it was about, I suppose the first thing to do is figure out how do we recognize when runners start their taper and how do we categorize different types of taper. And we looked at tapers in terms of two dimensions that we felt were important. Number one was the duration of the taper. So how many weeks before race day did they begin to reduce their training volume? And we found either 1, 2, 3, or 4 weeks tapers. And then the other somewhat novel feature that we looked at was how disciplined their taper was. And we were able to identify two common patterns in a taper. One was a strict taper, where runners gradually and consistently reduced their training volume week on week. So if it was a 3 week taper, 3 weeks out, they reduced by a little bit, 2 weeks out, a little bit more, 1 week out, a little bit more. That was a classic strict taper. But we were surprised at how often runners didn't follow that strict tapering pattern. And instead, we saw evidence of what we called a relaxed taper. And that was when someone started reducing their training volume. But in the middle of their taper, they had a week where they increased their training volume a little bit. So maybe they just got a bit nervous about how they were tapering and thinking, how could this be right? I'm losing fitness. And they had a week of higher volume. And we found that a lot of people actually did that. So we were able to compare tapers by different durations, as I said, 1, 2, 3, or 4 week tapers, and whether they were strict or whether they were relaxed. And on average, when we controlled for lots of different things, such as gender and runner ability, for example, we were able to show that on average, longer tapers did better than shorter tapers, where did better was defined in got you a faster finish time. And we found that strict tapers were associated with faster finish times than relaxed tapers.
I'm believing everything you're saying, but the taper is the part that makes me really, really nervous. And I find that the taper can be very subjective. And as a coach, if I'm telling somebody to taper, it's the part that always makes me nervous, because I think it's when you can get it wrong. So I think I might have a read over that paper again and go through it in more detail. And I suppose I'd like to practice it on myself and then maybe get one or two volunteers. But like, it is very, very detailed. And I would suggest that anybody listening in would try and get a listen to that. Again, I'll say it's entitled Longer Disciplined Tapers Improve Marathon Performance for Recreational Runners. I think that's available on the site medium.com. Sorry, Barry, I interrupted you there. So do you remember what you were saying?
No, that's quite all right. And you're right. It is on Medium. And what I tend to do is, most of this work gets published as a scientific paper. And then I try to kind of summarize it for a more general audience on medium.com. But that's a particularly detailed paper, all right. And what we found is that overall, 2 or 3 week tapers worked out best. And strict versions of those tapers worked out best for runners, which is, to be fair, that's pretty much consistent with the literature and what most coaches would suggest.
Yes.
I think there's some comfort in being able to say that the data on 158,000 recreational runners does support what your coach is telling you.
Right, so we've gone through the taper, we've gone through the expo and all that kind of stuff, and we're at the start line. How important is it to get the start right?
This is the first bit of real research I ever did on this way back, a good few years ago now. I was running my first marathon. Everyone was saying, don't go out too fast. And, you know, that kind of made sense. But at the same time, you wonder, well, how important is that? So we were able to, again, look at a large number of runners. At this stage, I've collected more than 4 million race records for marathoners across nearly 200 different races from around the world. And that data contains not just a marathon finish time, but also split times for 5 kilometers. So I basically focused on all of those marathons that published race data using 5 kilometer splits. Dublin doesn't do that, as a matter of interest, but most of the really big marathons do. And that was important because Dublin, the first split is the 10K split. I felt I really needed to have a look at the 5K split, because the 10K is a bit of a long distance to refer to as the start of the race. But anyway, a lot of the big city marathons publish 5 kilometer split times. And we were able to show that even when we control for runner ability, that runners who start too fast, and we define starting too fast as going out faster than your average race pace for that race. So if you went out faster than your average race pace for that race, you tended to finish slower than people who went out at around their average race pace. And the faster you went out, the slower you finished, the slower your overall finish time. Now, you might say, well, isn't that because all the really fast runners start at an even pace because they know what they're doing, and all the really the newbies all go out a bit too fast, and you find, sure enough, the ones that are starting at an even pace finish faster than the newbies who start too fast. But we controlled for that. So even when you control for all of those different aspects of a runner, you still find that starting too fast gives you a slower finish time overall. Same thing is true for starting too slow, by the way. So overly conservative pacing at the start of the race isn't a very good idea either. So you should try and start, those first 5K should be run at approximately the average pace you expect to achieve for the race.
Can I just mention something on that with starting too fast? If somebody is planning on running a 4-hour marathon, their average pace will be 5:40 per kilometre. That same person could probably run a 5K, say a park run, in between 24:30 and 25 minutes. So that's roughly 5 minutes a kilometre. That's 40 seconds faster than their marathon pace. So they might not consider that running around 5 minutes is too fast because they're able to run at 5 minutes a kilometre. But really, they should be going through their 5K split at an even paced marathon. So their 5K split should be around 28:20, which is 4 minutes slower. I remember when I made my first sub-3 attempt, and at halfway, I was 2 minutes ahead of schedule and I was delighted with myself. And just after that, the wheels come off and I ended up finishing 17 minutes slower. And I can remember looking back at the results for Dublin and I could see the 10K split and the halfway split. And I looked at the runners who were around me and behind me at halfway, and runners behind me finished in under 3 hours. And that was a big learning lesson for me about the even pace. And it still took a while for me to actually have the confidence to do that, because you don't feel you're going too fast.
No, you don't. And there's great excitement at the start line. So you're sort of whisked along. You're also feeling fresh because you've just come out of a nice couple of weeks of tapering. So you're feeling better than you have in the last 16 weeks, probably. And you just go with it. You're all excited. But the problem is that any pacing mistakes you make in those first few K, you have to live with those for the next 37, 38 K, you know, and that's tough. Whereas if you go a little too fast in a 5K segment of the race much later on, you don't have too long to go, so you can probably ride that one out. But going too fast at the start, you have to live with that for the rest of the race.
So when you're running, are you trusting the data rather than going by just how you feel? If you feel really good and you might think, actually, maybe today I'm in better shape than I think I am, would you still consider the research that you've done to keep yourself in check?
I do. I can honestly say that I do. Now, I tend to push it.
It's still hard, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And, you know, I'm sort of thinking, last year in Dublin, I did 3:18. So what's that? That's in the 4:40 range per kilometre. So I think I started out at around about 4:35. So I tend to do a positive split. And interestingly, when you analyse the data, most PBs for recreational runners are achieved with a very slight positive split. So compared to most elites, when they hit the world records are broken usually with a negative split. But most recreational runners can't manage their negative splits very well. I tend to go out just fractionally on the sort of faster side of my average pace and allow myself to lose a minute or two in the second half of the race. And that seems to work for me.
Right, okay. And I'll just mention now that a negative split is when you run the second half faster than the first half. And a positive split is when you run the first half faster than the second half. Now, as you mentioned, the positive split, is a positive split not something that might happen from running your first 5K too fast, which we are saying isn't the thing to do?
Yeah, it could. You have to be careful. You know, it's all degrees. So obviously, if your average race pace is, as you were saying, 5 minutes 40, if that's what you need to be hitting for your 4 minute or your 4 hour marathon, and you go out 40 seconds or a minute faster than that for your first 5K,
you're in trouble.
Blown it.
Yeah.
Yeah, big trouble.
Have you seen the splits of Kelvin Kiptum's Chicago Marathon compared to Kipchoge's?
I haven't looked at the direct comparison. I did watch it live.
Yeah,
on the day.
Well, here's an interesting one. Kiptum's, he was actually behind Kipchoge all the way up to 35 kilometres.
Yeah.
And that's when he started to pick it up. So his first 5K was 14:26 and Kipchoge was 14:14. Kiptum's fastest split was the 5K at 35K. He did 13:50:51. And previous to that, at 30K, that was his second fastest split, was 14:27. So he was actually behind the world record pace. So as you're watching it, you probably weren't thinking he's going to be getting the world record.
Well, I thought he might have a good shot at it because I knew he was a bit of an expert at negative splitting. Because
elite
athletes are great at negative splits. They really are superb.
Right, okay. Because as I looked at them kind of lined up, it was very, very interesting to see the two when they're compared.
Yeah.
And at the halfway mark, Kipchoge went through the halfway in Berlin in 59:51 and Kiptum went through the halfway in 60:48. That's a difference of 57 seconds.
Yeah.
Right. Now, let's get back to the Dublin Marathon. Would you recommend running with a pacer, especially for a recreational runner?
Yes, I would. And I actually, there's a Medium article on exactly this for the Dublin Marathon. And what I was interested in, so the question I was interested in then was, is there any evidence that people who run with pacers are more likely to get their finish time that they're aiming for? So, and you do see some evidence of this. So you, at the Dublin Marathon, I think this year, there's pacers every 10 minutes. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
That's
yes.
I was listening to your previous podcast. You talked about this.
Right. Yeah.
So there's pacers every 10 minutes. And you do, when I looked at the Dublin Marathon a few years ago, when there was 10 minute pacers as well, you found large spikes of runners crossing the finish line in and around those paced times. So certainly there's a good correlation there. And you might say, well, that's because they're these iconic times like 4 hours and 3 hours 30. But actually, it's not just that, because I was able to also look at the finishers when there was different pacers, when there was 15 minute pacers. And when there was 15 minute pacers, you found the same finisher spikes. You found more people finishing at the paced times, but they were at the 15 minute pace time. So all of a sudden, 3 hours and 45 minutes, there was a spike. But when there's a 10-minute pacer, there isn't a spike at 3 hours and 45 minutes. So whether it's a combination of because there's a pacer, more people tend to stick with them, or genuinely people are, once they're able to, the pacers help them manage their pace. It's probably a mixture of both of those things going on. But the data does suggest that the paced finish times have greater numbers of finishers than you would expect compared to the minutes before or after those paced times.
Yeah, when I was talking to Alex O'Shea about a pacing strategy, he alluded to something like that. When I was talking to him about marathon pacing, and we mentioned being a few seconds down, say, before the halfway mark, and runners within the group were starting to feel anxious and panicking, letting him know something that he already knew. And if they were on their own, they'd prefer to be ahead. They'd feel more comfortable in themselves, where he knew, okay, well, we can't just make up a big block of time in one go. We're going to gradually ease into that. And to me, that was kind of proving that there is that bit of a lack of discipline, especially when you're in a big race, when it means so much to you as well.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And especially, I've always found, and the sports science literature backs this up, that male runners take riskier pacing decisions than female runners. So they're much more likely to hit the wall. They're much more likely to get the pacing wrong. We get quite anxious.
What would you think is the main reason for somebody hitting the wall? Have you done any research on that?
Yeah, there's an article on Medium and there's a couple of research papers based on that as well. It's very difficult to say. All we could look at was race data. So we don't actually know how their nutrition was handled on the day. And for that particular research, we didn't know how their training had gone. So for sure, hitting the wall is linked with poor nutrition on the day. And a lot of that, no doubt, is happening. But it's also associated with poor pacing. And you found that two things came out really clear from that piece of research. One is that if you start too fast, you're much more likely to hit the wall. So that was a straightforward one. The other one, which surprised me a little but made sense in retrospect, is that we found that people who the 2 or 3 years before they achieved their PB, and in the 1 or 2 years after they achieved their PB, they were much more likely to hit the wall. Now, we defined hitting the wall as a pacing collapse of at least 25% for at least 5K in the second half of the marathon. So, in other words, a lot of slowing in the second half of the marathon. You could debate whether that's slowing enough to hit the wall or long enough to hit the wall, but we did various sensitivity analysis, and it was accepted as a useful operational definition of hitting the wall. But the point I'm making is that in the race where runners make their PB, they don't hit the wall. Almost by definition, they haven't hit the wall. But the year before, or 2 years before, or 3 years before they hit their PB, they're really quite likely to hit the wall. And the same in the years that directly follow a PB. And you can understand that. I think that what's happening there is that runners who are chasing a PB are more likely to make risky pacing decisions. And when they make risky pacing decisions, like going out a little bit too fast or pushing it too early on, then the wheels are likely to come off later in the race. And it's much more likely to happen to male runners than it is to female runners.
And I suppose with a marathon, if you haven't put the training in, you are going to get found out.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
Now, we talked about the importance of starting the race right. If you found that you were a bit behind at halfway, maybe you've had a congested start, you had kind of a forced slower pace in the beginning, would you try and make that up, or would you suggest a fast finish?
It's a tricky one. One of the things that I've been able to look at is the final 2.2 kilometres of these marathons, because the splits just allow you to do that. So you get splits up to 40K and then you've got that final 2.2K. And what we found there is that the people who speed up a lot in that final 2.2K, they tend to have poorer finish times than the people who don't speed up a lot. So why is that? I think one reason is that the fact that you can speed up a lot probably means that you've run a bit too conservatively up until that point in the race. And this just speaks to the difficulty of getting marathon pacing right, of course. But we found that people who start fast tend to have poorer finish times, we see a very similar relationship between people who finish fast. And again, we find that people who finish close to their race pace on average, or maybe a little bit faster or a little bit slower, they tend to get their best finish times. And it's one of the reasons why my own intuition is that recreational runners are not good at managing a negative split. So those people who think, I'm going to try and do the second half faster, and then you find that, I can actually push it now for the final 2K or so, and they push it. They've got energy still left in them. Who's to say that when they cross that finish line, they've used up all their energy? I think it's quite likely that maybe they've even a little bit more in them, but they're just, because we're recreational runners, we're not so used to running full marathon distance. We're just not sure how to spend that energy efficiently in the race. And so I kind of tend to think, don't plan for a fast finish because you mightn't get your best overall time.
It's interesting there when you mentioned your intuition, and we're talking about machine learning and artificial intelligence. Do you then use your intuition to maybe, if you're analysing the splits, maybe if something happens that there was a bit of extra congestion during a marathon course, or a tree fell down and delayed people. I don't really know what I'm getting at, but just when you mentioned the intuition, I'm just kind of wondering, are you kind of looking at some of these findings subjectively as well?
You mean at personal level?
Yeah. But say, because like you have skin in the game, and I'm wondering, have you ever proved yourself wrong by using your intuition?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I started doing this data analysis to help me, you know, at a personal level. I actually didn't think it would turn into all of these publications. I didn't even plan to write blog posts about it.
I'm loving them, and it just has me so curious, because when I'm hearing artificial intelligence and recommender systems, and if somebody was to ring, if I was meeting somebody in a cafe and they rang me up and say, "Will I get you a sandwich? What do you want?" I mightn't know what I want, because it depends on how hungry I am, it depends on what they have available, and it can be hard to make an actual decision, especially if you're presented with a lot of choice.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering, it's fascinating. And you mentioned how women running kind of more evenly than men. If you were to design or pick a perfect pacer, would you give me an idea on what that would be?
Well, I think certainly female runners seem to manage their pace better.
And I see that with the ultra running especially.
Yeah. Now, there is a flip side to that. There is also some evidence that female runners are more likely to speed up in the final segment of the race, that final 2.2K. So there is the risk that they've managed their pacing a little bit too conservatively.
Right.
But on balance, you've got male runners who are just shooting out of the blocks, and they're more likely to hit the wall than female runners. And sometimes it could be, you know, 50% more likely, 60% more likely to hit the wall. So it's quite a big difference.
Maybe that's why female runners do better in the ultra distance as well, because it's going on for a longer time. So if you have a 24-hour race, and that's when pacing becomes really crucial, that you can't make any mistakes with the pacing. Like what I find is with a marathon, if you're going for a PB in a marathon, and if you lose your concentration, you'll end up slowing down. If you're doing an ultra marathon, you lose concentration, you end up speeding up. And both are good. Both are bad, depending on the actual race. So I think, it's really, really interesting. What recommendations would you have for somebody to have their perfect race? Say somebody going into this as their first race now, they're going through the taper and on the day.
Yeah, well, that's a good question. So a few days ago, I kind of, because Dublin was coming up and then New York won't be long after it, I did a blog post, which was six lessons for recreational runners to run their best marathon. So this is kind of a summary. You don't want to spend time reading all the other articles because you're too busy for that. Here's a quick summary of the lessons learned. So I'll go through those. This is how I would recommend runners approach their marathon, whether they're going for a PB or just looking for a good day at the races, so to speak. So lesson number one, we're all tapering now. I think trust your taper and taper carefully. You're in the middle of your taper, so just stick with it. Whatever your marathon plan says or whatever your coach has advised you, that's probably the right thing to do. Even though we all get a little bit nervous and have our little taper tantrums as we go along, it's an important part of being ready for race day. So I'd say lesson number one is trust that. Lesson number two has to be don't start too fast. So you need to figure out, and there's various ways to do this, what is a reasonable, a tough but achievable finish time, assuming you want to run your best race. So what do you think your training has made you capable of? And you should have a good sense of that at this stage. Maybe you've run a half marathon during training. Maybe your interval sessions are helping you to calibrate what you think you can do on race day. So figure out what that finish time, your A finish time is. Have a backup time as well in case things go wrong. But what's the target time you're aiming for? And work out your average pacing per kilometer or per mile, however you want to do it. And make sure that you start at around that pace. Don't go much faster than that. Don't go much slower. Try and start out at that pace. The third lesson I would say is that there's a suggestion that we should all be aiming for negative splits, that because most world records are achieved with negative splits, that that's what recreational runners should do as well. The data doesn't really support that. The data is much more consistent with a pacing pattern, which is called a controlled fade. I'd never come across this till I started analysing the data, and I saw that most people got their PB with a slight positive split, where the second half of the race was about 1-3% longer than or slower, if you like, than the first half of the race. And when I started reading up on it, I found that people were referring to this as a controlled fade. So the controlled fade seems to be a good pacing pattern for or pacing strategy for recreational runners. So figure out if you've got a finish time of 4 hours, then you might, an even pace means you're running your first half in about 2 hours and your second half in about 2 hours. Well, a controlled fade might say that you'll run your first half maybe in just under 2 hours and your second half slightly over 2 hours. So maybe 1:58 or 1:59 for your first half and 2 hours and one or 2 hours and two for your second half. And most recreational runners achieve their PBs with a controlled fade and with that type of pacing. And I think it's because we're not really experienced enough to manage a negative split as well as the elites or highly trained runners. And so that's lesson number three. Lesson number four is, if you have a sensible finish time and there are pacers running that finish time, then it's probably a good idea to go out with those pacers and trust those pacers. They probably know the course better than you, and they probably know how to run the course better than you. And it might seem like they start a little bit slow, but that might be prudent given the conditions or given the course. But you can be sure that those pacers will be crossing the finish line at or just before the target time they're aiming for. And the evidence suggests that people who stick with pacers tend to do well. The fifth lesson of six is, watch out for hitting the wall and the risky pacing decisions that make you more likely to hit the wall. So risky pacing decision number one, as we mentioned a moment ago, is starting too fast. But in general, if you're aiming for a PB, don't fall into the trap of picking a target finish time that's a little bit too unachievable, because that'll cause you to plan a pacing strategy that you're not going to make. And we do see that when people are aiming for PBs, that they are more likely to hit the wall. So just bear that in mind. And then the final lesson was really, don't plan for a fast finish. Because again, we find that the people who finish the strongest, especially those who are sprinting in the last kilometer or two of the marathon, relatively speaking, they don't tend to achieve their best finish times. So it's as if, again, the risk is that they're crossing the finish line really fast and they probably have more left in the tank and they didn't get to spend it all. So don't plan for that. Try to plan for a more or less even finish pace. And that means you're much more likely to put it all out there on the race course. And I suppose a bonus tip that I called out is that don't give up here. Practice makes perfect. All the evidence suggests that the more marathons you do, the better your overall race times will be. Even when we account for age. Now, that doesn't mean you can expect a PB every year. And as we get older, we do tend to get slower. But relatively speaking, we tend to do better. We tend to hit the wall less often. We tend to avoid making pacing mistakes the more marathons we have under our belt. So even if your marathon doesn't go too well this time, don't worry. Get back up on the horse. It'll go better next time, almost guaranteed.
Brilliant. And I have to agree with that. Practice makes perfect. And with a race like the marathon, it's something that you have to experience. There's a saying that in practice, the theory should work. But in practice, the theory won't always work. You have to actually experience it for yourself. That's how you learn the lesson of not going out too fast and sticking and being conservative with your pacing. And so that's excellent. So I think that's a lot for a lot of information there. And if anybody's looking to read your blog or any of your papers, medium.com, they're all available there. And there recently you were one of the speakers on the running symposium that was organised by the Gerty Kiernan Foundation, and that was a great event. So Barry, thanks very much for all that. Have you anything else you can think of to finish up on? Or
I heard recently, you might believe it on your podcast, John, this lovely quote that was, let me see how it went, that marathons are, it's not about getting a great time, it's about having a
great time. Yeah, actually, that was me. That was talking to Noel Carroll. Yeah, brilliant. Well, especially for the first
that
one.
That actually spoke to me.
Yeah, and a friend of mine was over in Chicago. And I was asking him, was he going for any particular time? And he said, no, he was going over, it's a holiday. He had a 6-hour flight.
Yeah.
He's going to be on his feet all day. And the last thing he's going to worry about is running a PB. He likes doing the city marathons because it's like doing a city tour on foot. The marathon route's going to take you around the nicest areas. You get to see everything, great atmosphere. And he gets a holiday, the weekend away, and a marathon thrown in as well. And I'd be the same. I like to kind of pick places to go based, let the races decide where they go, and you end up visiting places that you wouldn't have actually planned to go to. So after Dublin, have you anything in mind following on from that?
I do. My Dublin time last year got me into Boston next year.
Super.
So for the first time ever, I'll be doing the spring marathon.
Right.
So I'm really looking forward to that. And I would say as well, one of the revelations for me this year was how great it is to join a running club.
Yes,
I
most definitely.
I joined a cool athletic club this year. And for 10 years, I've been training on my own, by and large. You know, the odd run with mates, but most of the training on my own. And it's been fine. I'm fairly disciplined. But, you know, running with other runners on a regular basis, and especially the camaraderie that comes from a running club like Kilcool, is just an absolute revelation for me. You know, all weathers, doesn't matter. It's all great fun. So I'd really encourage people who are starting along this journey to find their local club and to realise that, especially in these running clubs, it's never about finish time. It's just about enjoying your time out there. And the other thing I would say to people as well, which I practice myself, when I'm training on my own, I always have my earbuds in, and I'm always listening to podcasts, and usually about marathon running. But when I'm racing, when I'm doing a race, I never have my headphones on. And it's great, you know, just to experience the noise and the footfall of the Dublin Marathon or the Dublin Half Marathon without the intrusion of music or podcasts and all that is lovely, I find. So it's a real treat when I'm doing a race not to wear the headphones and just listen to what's going on around you, and those half overheard conversations about how people are feeling, and the encouragement you get when you go by someone, or being dragged along when you're slipping back, I think is really worth it. So I'd really encourage people to leave the headphones at home.
Yes, most definitely. When you're in the race, you're able to absorb all that energy from the crowd, and it's a really positive sound that you get, and it just pulls you along. It's like a wave that you're floating on.
And you might feel that you need your power song in your ear for when it gets tough, but I guarantee you, you'll get much more from the people around you on race day.
Music is something that really interests me. What is your power song? Or do you want to give that away? Okay, well, look at.
I genuinely don't. I usually like the spoken words, but here's a little snippet of that interests me. I've worked with a couple of guys, and they're very interested in music, and they were looking at running and looking at ways in which you could adjust the tempo of the song you were listening to match your pace to match a target pace. And it was really interesting. You know, you could imperceptibly change the music tempo to encourage the runner to hit a slightly different cadence or go a little bit faster.
Okay, yeah.
And just thought, that's a really nice idea.
Yeah, because there is DJ software that will do that to help you align two tracks together, and you can put both of them slightly out of sync, and then you join them up. But I've mentioned to someone there when the Sony Discman came out, first of all, I remember getting one of those and running. It was the Walkman, and they had one designed for running. It had a hard plastic case, was waterproof. And I had a cassette, which was Bob
the
Marley's.
Yellow one.
Yeah, that's the one. And I had a Bob Marley cassette, Babylon by Bus. And I can remember running with Babylon by Bus playing, and your pace would change to the point where sometimes you think you feel like you were going backwards. Because you were really getting into the tempo. But then I was running on the canal one time, and someone came from behind me on a bike. I didn't actually hear them until they were beside me. Got a bit of a scare. And that stopped me from kind of using it since then. But on occasion now, I do listen to a bit of music, especially if I'm on the treadmill, or I do like to listen to a podcast. But sometimes I find that I really zone out. If I'm running on my own along the canal towpath or in a forested area, I end up zoning out and I forget what I've actually been listening to. And then I have to listen back to it again. Like, so I find that sometimes, like, especially with an audiobook, it can take a lot of concentration.
Yeah, I find that as well. And, you know, I must appear to be very rude to my neighbours as I'm running around here, because I rarely say hello to people because I'm just in my own little world. So I'll apologise on air to them now.
Okay. And Kilcool is a great club as well. And a big advantage with being in a club as well is you're surrounded by like-minded people. And when you have definite times to be going to training sessions, it does help.
Because
I was on the track last night, and we were running in the rain. And if it wasn't for a group run, we wouldn't have had the same numbers there. And people were there and they were talking about the taper. They were giving out about it. They were enjoying the run at the same time. Then when it finished, you could see the smiles on people's faces. And they were planning what they were going to do next. And they were debating different runs. What are you doing? What are you? Why are you doing that? And again, that's what I mean. It can be so personal to people. And if somebody's telling me what they're doing or asking me what I think they should do, I kind of involve them in it as well, because I always find this really, really hard to get right. So I'm going to share that paper with them, and I will be directing people to medium.com, because I found it has been a really good resource, and I do enjoy reading over the articles. And thanks again for your time and making yourself available. Like, I really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
I was kind of cold calling at that time out in UCD, so I was kind of glad that I did actually have a quick chat with you then. Because when
I love talking about this stuff.
Yeah, well, that's great, because it's something I was really interested in, but it's knowing the questions to ask, because when you're answering some questions there, you were kind of sending me off on a bit of a tangent. There was different questions kind of coming to mind, and I didn't want to get away from asking the questions that I thought were important. So I think your most recent post, the 6 lessons for recreational runners, which you read out there, I think that's a really, really good way to finish. So they are the kind of main takeaways. And it's also obvious, but so obvious that you don't actually think about it. It has to be said to you again. Good luck in Dublin, and thanks again for your time.
Thank you.
And for anybody listening in, if you enjoyed this, please leave a review on Spotify or pass it on to somebody. And until next time.